Hello. I'm going to get going because my whole point is to play some really beautiful audio for you, and I want you guys to have a chance to hear the stuff that I've brought. However, I'm also going to tell you a little bit about the festival I work for. I'm Julie Shapiro. I'm the managing director for the Third Coast International Audio Festival, which in the simplest terms is a celebration of exemplary documentary feature audio and radio work being made all over the world. We're in our second year, based at Chicago Public Radio in Chicago, and we have been lovingly, well, it's a term we've come to think of lovingly, been described in the local media as a four-headed monster. Proud to announce that we grew a head this year. We're now a five-headed monster. The festival is comprised of five main elements. There's a competition that awards cash prizes to producers for audio work that's judged by a panel of two dozen judges once a year. There's a conference, a website, a broadcast, and we just started this year. Our fifth head is a public listening series, which is something I'll talk about a little, but also want to encourage all of you to think about starting in your communities, because it's really simple, and people have been super receptive and excited about this idea. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the festival. You can feel free to ask me questions at any point, but then we'll just move into listening. What we're going to be listening to is some of the work that was awarded prizes last year at our first competition, as well as a couple other pieces that I'm particularly fond of or have caught my ear and I just would love to share with you. So let's see. I'll start with the competition. It's one of the only ones in North America that's concentrating especially on documentary work for radio and the audio. And we take entries for work that's been either broadcast or posted on a website or exhibited in a museum or gallery setting. So it's really open to people making their own work. They don't necessarily have to go through station routes. And it doesn't have to be broadcast on any sort of station necessarily. All that work's, of course, welcome as well. But we have a general overall best documentary category and a public service award that we give out every year and a best new artist award for newcomers to the field. Our conference is coming up in November, and so I would encourage you all to maybe think about coming. I've left some material over there. We just basically bring producers together to talk about the art and the craft of making radio. Because, of course, all the issues are super important, but sometimes in the midst of all that, you don't get a chance to actually talk about making radio and different ways of thinking about audio and telling stories. So that's the main goal of the conference. We have listening sessions there. We do presentations. We do panels. This year we're going to have one-on-one editing and critique sessions with producers. We're also starting up a pretty hefty youth track. So if any of you are involved with youth and radio, please do contact me because we'll be looking for ways to involve more youth as the festival grows, because that's obviously the future of all of this. So we do one broadcast a year with the winning material from the competition and other interesting things that come our way throughout the year, so it's not just the prize-winning material. But that's hosted this year by Robert Krolwich from ABC, and it'll be distributed around the holiday times. We try to promote it as a non-holiday content holiday programming, because it's usually last year was 3 hours, this year will be 2 hours of broadcast. Let's see. The website is thirdcoastfestival.org, and we put up a new documentary or feature every 2 weeks on that, along with an interview with the producer that's made the work. We have a sort of catalog of the festival developments on the website, and it's also a place to go to find other links to other audio sites where you can mainly hear a lot of audio and learn ways to make it yourself. There's a lot of links to sources with tools and tips to making radio. Let's see what else about the website. You can recommend work to be featured on the website through the website. We really encourage interaction from the people that are hearing this work and coming to the website. I'm excited. In 2 weeks, I think next Tuesday, we're going to post our first ever international doc. It's actually in German, so there'll be a transcript available to download, and we're going to see what sort of response we get, but it's about Raymond Carver. There's an Austrian producer who is obsessed with Raymond Carver, and he made a doc about him in German. So it's a real interesting sort of blend of an outsider's look at an American author. So I encourage you all to try to stick it out and listen. And then we do this public listening series, which we're calling The Listening Room. It's named after an Australian Broadcasting Corporation show called The Listening Room. And every other month, we invite people to come out in a theater setting. We have local producers sort of host the sessions where they play excerpts of audio and encourage interaction from the audience. A little bit of what I'm going to do today, actually. I would welcome any feedback on the stuff that you hear, just impressions, ideas, questions. And people have been really coming out to this. We keep it, it's like $3 to come. We got a local theater to donate the space, which was really nice, a brand new theater. But this is something you can do in your living rooms. You don't need a public space to do it. You can make announcements on air. You can do it at the stations. People really are open and excited about the idea of talking about the work that they hear in a group setting with other people. So I would encourage all of you guys to give it a try, at least. It's been really successful so far. I guess that's sort of the festival in a nutshell. It's our second year. We're hoping to do this annually. And I'm excited to be here because I really feel like we can expand the community of people we're working with and who are coming to the conference to share their own experiences and are listening to the work and are making work for possibly the website or for the competition or just for each other. This has been a great way for people to meet each other. And the seeds of collaborations have been planted and then have grown into big projects that have really, we've heard projects made by people that collaborated after meeting at the conference. So it's been really exciting to see how it's generating actual content. And it's just a way for producers to come together and put faces to names and you know, brainstorm and celebrate everything that they're dedicating their lives to. So without further ado, unless there's questions, I just wanted to sort of jump into the listening to give you guys a break from all the talking. Or a time to absorb all the talking, I should say. Not that anyone needs a break yet, but I think I'll just jump in. The first program, and I'm playing excerpts because most of these are a bit longer, and on a beautiful sunny day in the middle of a conference, maybe you don't want to hear entire half-hour pieces. The first excerpt I'm going to play is the piece that won our director's choice last year. We have a bronze, a gold, silver, bronze, a couple honorable mentions, Best New Artist, Public Service Award, and then we've reserved the right to pick a piece that wasn't awarded by the judges but that we thought was exceptional for whatever reason. And so this is the award that got this last year. It was produced by Susan Stone from KPFA, and she's an independent producer out there. Well, she works with KPFA, but it's called Rip, Rift, and Panic, and it's sort of a collage of impressions from people who live along a fault line. So it's all about living along a fault line on the West Coast. So I'm going to go right to that. Help me monitor the volume, if you will, just simply that way. Oh, I'm going to tell you, too, it's 5.5 minutes long, this excerpt. We found through the listening series, and this is maybe a tip for you if you take this on. People really pay attention better if they know how long they're going to be listening. Otherwise, they spend a lot of time wondering how much longer it's going to go on and not really listening. So, 5:30.
Have you checked Peter Shickley's Shickley Mix?
Shickley Mix, no.
El silencio es casi tan espantoso como el terremoto mismo.
You know, I can't cross a bridge, go through a tunnel, or anything without thinking of them. I don't know, sometimes it's too much, just not knowing when it's coming, you know?
I was sitting in the office, and I was talking to someone on the phone and kind of looking out the window, and the earthquake started. And I looked over into my partner's room, and it went from a square to a rectangle, back to a square. And I said, wow.
We just talked, the four of us talked, and waited for the building to collapse, you know, just hugging each other and waiting.
With all these earthquakes and the way this city's built, I think it's built to burn.
Hernan is the quarterback for Saddleback. He hands off to Don Shedrick. Shedrick, the ball carrier. And he gained about 3 yards on the play. And we are getting ourselves a pretty good earthquake here, folks. And that's it. Nobody else wants to play football. They want to go home. Let's hope everybody's all right. That was a pretty stiff one. This press box up here is a little flimsy, and we can really feel it up here on the top of the press box.
Oh, it was 15 seconds. It seemed like it lasted a long time. And when it stopped, it was completely quiet. The city was completely quiet.
We need one of your units to check the county services building. We have reports that there's major structural damage inside that building at this time. They have evacuated.
This isn't going to happen to me. We're all going to be safe. We're all going to get through this. I mean, this is what scenarios we all say in our mind to make us feel better.
Disasters, by their nature, are unpredictable. They are never the way you plan them to be. So you've got to build in flexibility, be able to think on your feet, make quick decisions, have resources available to deal with the unexpected.
Stuffed animal, shoes, clothes, t-shirts.
Spare batteries and spare water stored in different parts of my house.
Body bags, first aid supplies. People say, well, I have canned goods, I have food and water at home, I've got my flashlight and my radio, and they think that's all they need. But they don't go beyond the scope of what if you end up in a mass care shelter and there are hundreds of people there, where is everyone going to go to the bathroom?
I was not properly dressed for an earthquake, and I was standing at the end of my bed when everything started to shake. It didn't seem like the normal type of shaking. It seemed worse, swaying. The walls came together, and a very large, solid door popped out, and it hit me in the chest and knocked me backward. So I fell on my back into my hallway, and the two floors above it fell on top of me. My watch was gone and ring was gone, and the force of the blow when the door hit me must have knocked him off. Afterwards, I've been told that I was buried alive and you had a building fall on you or something like that. But you just don't realize that at the time.
1 minute later, you could hear the sound of dozens and dozens of sirens, police cars, firefighters, ambulances. You have a city of 20 million people in shock. And then tens of thousands of people standing in the middle of the street trying to stay away from the buildings. People were crying, people were praying. A lot of them were in shock, just doing nothing, just staring at the buildings.
While we were sort of all happy to be alive, we realized that we were in the midst of a big disaster, because right where we were, the horizon was the freeway, and it wasn't there anymore. It was kind of lopsided. You could sort of see in through the haze, and then somebody said, it fell down. And a semi had flown off the top and had landed, you know, head first or whatever, right, you know, in the middle of the road, and the guy was dead. I mean, he was, you know, he didn't have a chance. He was crushed behind, you know, the load of his tractor-trailer combination.
I looked, and the whole sky was lit up like clockwork orange. It was completely bright orange and red. And then, just as I noticed that, I looked down, and a woman ran out from a house and then ran back in front of my car. I mean, I almost hit her. And I remember panicking and thinking, okay, you don't have the option here to feel. And I turned, and I saw that the streets were buckled, houses were falling over. I mean, it was very strange.
So that goes on for actually another 22 minutes. I want to also step back a little bit and explain to you why the Third Coast came into existence, because it's pretty important. We sensed Johanna Zorn is the director of the festival. She's worked at WBEZ for 20 years. And in her experience, she's been sensing this, and along with a lot of other people, a real renaissance of the documentary form across mediums. And we thought radio is not being left out of this, and that it was really time to create a vehicle through which to recognize the power of documentary and storytelling, all sorts of stories across the board. So we made this as a way to sort of raise the visibility, or the audibility, I suppose, to bring more work to a broader audience. And the hope is really to generate excitement internally within the producing community for documentary work, but also within the listening community. So people are realizing the value and the power of these stories to tell certain messages, to tell stories, to share experiences. And so we're just really trying to bring that to the forefront of radio, you know, to the best of our ability and to the best of the work that's out there, just giving it a wider listening audience. So that's one of the main goals. And now we will move on to... Also, if you want to, if anyone has questions about the excerpts, at this point I'm pretty familiar with having talked to the producers a lot about them, so I can try to answer questions, not necessarily in their words, but on their behalf. And if you want to hear any of the entire pieces, you can go to our website and they're all posted there. Yeah?
I have a question. How would the producer have got hold of the footage where the guy was announcing the football game?
You know, I had the same question. I was told that that was actually pretty widely distributed audio material. So it was archived somewhere in the news tapes, but that clip, that instance, was such a perfect example of it happening that it was used in different ways. And she collected material over 5 or 8 years and put it all into this. So it wasn't all done in a short amount of time after a big earthquake. Yeah. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, yeah. I don't think she didn't happen to be recording that day. It was available. Yeah, apparently a couple people have used it. Okay, so the next one we're gonna take you somewhere totally different. This was our Bronze Award winner last year, produced by an Australian producer named Natalie Kestetcher, and it's about her obsession with all things Austrian. It's called Von Trapped. You're gonna hear a slightly longer excerpt. I think you'll enjoy it.
Well, it runs around Salzburg. You get a great view of the city. You get a great idea of some of the history of Salzburg. You make two stops. They're both Sound of Music related places. For example, that little gazebo, which always brings a little bit of romanticism into the tour, and the major house, which they used in the movie. Then after a little bit of a heavy bashing of information, you head to the country, the tour relaxes, you absorb some wonderful scenery, you go through some lakes, some mountains, and you visit some lovely little villages in the Austrian countryside.
Clean.
That's beautiful. Isn't perfect.
Spotless.
Spotless.
Streets.
Spotless.
People are spotless. The cars are spotless.
Everything's spotless.
Edelweiss. Edelweiss. Every morning you greet me.
The Austrian people were 75% to 80% in favor of the annexation. The reason for this was they watched the people in Germany, the promises the Nazis made of a better life. They were very tough times. There was a large part of the population illegally organized, even maybe for the last 10 years. Therefore, the annexation of Austria was really made or done with a minimum of fuss.
An unabashed fan of some of the policies of Adolf Hitler is now one of the most powerful politicians in Austria.
Every house on the 13th of March 1938 had a Nazi flag in preparation for the arrival of Hitler. And every third person, second person, whatever, was instead of their work uniform in a prepared Nazi uniform.
I have a secret. Something no one knows anything about. Except you. We will soon.
I'm Nicholas Hammond, and many years ago I played Friedrich von Trapp in a film called The Sound of Music.
You see, I'm ashamed. It's an addiction. No, not drugs. Gambling. If only. It's far more embarrassing than that.
It seems to be something that people still like to see, and the family seems to be a family that people still kind of relate to.
My addiction renders my life a fantasy, a world inhabited by smiling blondes who beckon me. Like this. I only have relationships with Austrians. And when we're together, you know, intimately, I imagine that I'm with my fantasy blonde. And of course, nothing can ever really develop, and I can't develop. Which is why I'm here talking to you.
People get on the tour dressed up. People come as nuns. People come with guitars and all sorts of stuff. And I encourage that, you know. It adds a bit of atmosphere to the whole tour.
Well, Austrians or...
No, of course, Australians and Americans. The Austrians just don't do the tour.
They just don't do it.
No, not interested.
Australians come dressed as nuns.
Of course they do. I mean, this is... I think it adds to the whole ear of the Sound of Music. The Sound of Music tour, as I see it.
I'm Friedrich. I'm 14. I'm impossible.
Really?
It was a great character to play, largely because, for me, I was completely in awe of Christopher Plummer. And it was easy to play a boy who is completely in awe of his father and desperately wants his father's approval. And I was just completely in love with Julie, you know, just absolutely, totally in love with her.
You see, since the age of 10, I've been in love with Captain Georg von Trapp. Yes, the Sound of Music Captain von Trapp. I've been in love with him and imagined myself as his wife, lover, and even his child.
Of 28.4% plus 6.5%.
Nearly 30% of Austrian voters have bought the fiercely anti-immigrant, extremist right-wing policies of the flamboyant, Porsche-driving populist Jörg Haider. The son of a former Nazi official has in the past openly praised some of the policies of the Nazi regime.
The rise of Haider is not something what comes out of the blue. What now becomes evident that comparably large percentages of Austrians, of almost 30%, are supporting this right-wing party. And Haider himself presents himself as a kind of Austrian Tony Blair, young, successful, good-looking, charismatic, brilliant orator. And the messages which he is now disseminating attract a large number of Austrians, but not all. And the response in Austria itself shows that Austria more or less is split.
Clean.
Us. Beautiful. Isn't perfect.
Spotless.
Spotless. Spotless.
As a child, I believed that being born blonde was the first and essential step to being successful and happy. Bottle blonde was not an option, because to me, blonde was not simply a hair colour. Blondes were blonde inside and out. Blondes could do cartwheels and handstands. Their sandwiches were white and fresh with delicious pink fillings. Ham, jam, corned beef.
Come and we'll walk around, and I can give you a better view now because of the trees here. But, yeah, if you look across the lake, you'll notice that there's that big white house there, and you probably recognise it straight away. The most important features of the house that will stand out to you will be the terrace area. And they filmed a couple of scenes here on this terrace where, you remember there was a scene where good old Rolf, the postman, our friend, he came round with that little rock and threw it up at the window trying to get Liesl out of bed that morning.
The Nazi.
The Nazi guy. Well, you shouldn't talk about that in Austria now because it's a topical subject. But yeah, the little Nazi guy.
What are you doing there?
Oh, Captain von Trapp.
I was just looking for... I didn't see. I mean, I didn't know you were... Heil Hitler!
Blondes were Church of England. They went to fellowship and had no problems with monkey bars. Blondes had Christmas trees with angels on top and Christmas presents and brown legs and golden down.
My mother didn't look very Jewish, you know. Sometimes, you know, you look it a little bit, and the Austrians were very aware of the looks. And we didn't look particular Jewish. My brother was very blonde, and I was blonde too at the time. So I really didn't experience much personal aggravation and trouble. But we were listening to stories. There was a particular Jewish district where many, many religious Jews lived. It was the second district. After the First World War, they came from Poland. And they suffered much more than we little bit assimilated Jews who didn't look any different from the others.
But so being blonde helped.
Yet being blonde helped.
My family was not blonde.
So that was Von Trapp. It continues for it's about a half hour doc altogether. But I think I'll jump ahead to what was our gold award winner last year. Took the top prize out of all of over 300 entries, and it was a piece called "The Vietnam Tapes" of Lance Corporal Michael A. Baranowski. And this was a piece that came out of, if you listened to NPR, the Lost and Found Sound series produced by the Kitchen Sisters and Jay Allison. This was a piece that came out of that project. And it's about recovered tapes from, I want to get it right, a Marine who was stationed over fighting, and he had a tape recorder with him. And he made all these tapes of his experience and had sort of fake broadcasts going on from there. And he died. He didn't make it out of the war, but these tapes were recovered years and years later by his family and turned over to them. And they worked with, well, you'll hear, but it turned into about a 25-minute documentary. We're only going to hear the first 5.5 minutes, but this one is like, if you go and listen to one of these afterward, I would go and hear this whole one. It's really something. So,
what was his name?
Michael A. Baranowski, and it was Lance Corporal Michael A. Baranowski. And it was originally part of that Lost and Found Sound series and produced by Jay Allison and Christina Egloff.
Thank you.
playing on the back.
Well, we try to deal with that. I also brought along something unrelated to our festival, but something that I think is some of the most brilliant audio documentary work that was ever made by a Canadian pianist named Glenn Gould. He's well known for his musical contributions, not as well known as a radio producer, but he did some work with the CBC. And he did a seminal trilogy called the Solitude Trilogy, where they're 3-hour-long presentations of concepts about living in the north in Canada, further north than that, the ideas of isolation and communities living separated from the rest of their country. So I have this backup. I'm going to play the beginning of the Solitude Trilogy, where you can hear some of the techniques that he was really, now to our ears, they may not sound that groundbreaking, but when he did this work in the 70s, it was really unlike stuff people had ever heard, so hope we'll jump to that for now. You'll see, as a composer, he really composed with the tape that he would get, and he almost builds musical compositions out of the voices. He uses them not just to tell the story, but also as musical instruments. So. Oh, no. Okay, questions.
I have a question.
Sure.
In your competition, how many of these people competed for first-time producers?
We had, it's hard to say first-time. Our Best New Artist category is open to people that have been in the field for 2 years or less. And it gets really blurry, because, of course, if you work on work, often you'll have an editor, you'll have someone helping you write, or, you know, at some points along the way, you always have some help. I would think. But we had about, let's see, last year there were probably about 40 entries from Best New Artists, and it's about up there again this year. It was really an interesting breakdown. We're starting to see more entries from people that are working in audio but not necessarily have ever done documentary work and are, you know, piecing together other skills. And because you can download Pro Tools for free, you can do all the editing at home, it's really becoming something that people not necessarily involved with stations are actually taking up on their own to do. So I would say, and the conference especially attracted a lot of people that were just entering the radio world, and a lot of people hooked up that way. So
now, in the conference itself, do you provide workshops for production?
There's less actual hands-on. We're doing a little more of that this year because we did a lot of sort of talking about what is a story and more abstract notions last year, and from feedback forums, we learned that people wanted a little bit more how-to, so we're trying to do that in the afternoons this year. People will have 4 choices on, for instance, using music in a piece or voice in a piece or interviewing techniques, as well as how to get your air heard, how to work with distribution systems and things like that, too. So we're trying to balance that out a little bit this year. Yeah. It's all posted on our website right now. The sound file, the audio files are all there, except Von Trapped, because following up on the rights issues we talked about this morning, it's really hard to get international streaming rights, or not even streaming, but posting rights. So we're working on all of that. If anyone really wanted to hear it, I'd be happy to send you a copy of it. She doesn't mind. I know the producer well enough. She's happy to have anyone that wants to hear it listen to it. Yeah. It's just, you know, because that one came from Australia. She actually sent a log of all of the material that came with it. I think that's pretty standard for the ABC, at least, to record stuff that way. Okay. But, yeah, I think the rights issues are pretty messy, actually. And because we put stuff on the web and then offered in the broadcast, that's something that we're still developing, a better way to make things more clear for producers who are submitting their work and want to retain control over it. Yeah. Oh, the Third Coast? The terminology, of course, is tricky. We're a project of Chicago Public Radio, so basically the board of BEZ approved the station to go ahead and raise the money for this festival. So the station raises all the money through private foundations, through the CPB kicked in last year, but we have in Chicago a very generous private funder, which we're very, very lucky for and grateful for. So, but the station is behind generating the operating budget for the festival.
And also
Ira Glass hosted the broadcast last year, and so he was involved in that way. And that helped, you know, people. Our first year did really help give it legitimacy in a world that's flooded with tons of programming, in a way. But the staff is actually just myself and this other woman and a part-time person, so we're pretty small. But we work at the station. We're centered at BEZ, so we have all the operating tools that they can offer. So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the submission process? Do people, like, post MP3s to your website, and they have to, like, submit it other ways? Do you have, like, submission guidelines? Like, what makes up a documentary? What criteria do you
use? I'm glad you asked, because that is a question that's never really answered. And we get stuff that's all over the board. We encourage stuff that's untraditional. We really want people to push the envelope. Submission process, the reason I didn't bring it up right away is our entry deadline just passed about 2 weeks ago for this year. So we're doing it every year. I hope to make some friendships and connections here that are sustained through next year. But on the question of what is a documentary, I will refer to this year's entry form, because this is what we've come up with. And it's vague, and we purposefully keep it vague because we really want people to interpret it any way that they want to. Within reason. Okay. We're looking for stories that document a place, time, person, event, community, or issue. These might be investigative reports, narrative stories, personal essays, or audio portraits. We're interested in work with a social mission and stories that entertain. Musical and historical documentaries are welcome. Profiles and cultural snapshots are welcome. Intimate stories and sound-rich features are welcome. So that's as specific as we get. And we get stuff that's really all over the spectrum, which is very exciting to hear people are doing this kind of work. So.
Do you also have, like, technical criteria? Like, do people have to have, like, an MP3, like, 128 kb?
We haven't really gone into the MP3 realm. With the entries, we need people to send stuff in on tape so it can be judged in a communal setting. So we'd accept CDs or tapes. And the qualifications are that it has to have either aired or been posted. So anyone in this room could make a documentary, put it on your website, and it's eligible. Or have been presented in a public, like a museum or installation gathering.
But it has to have been published in some sense.
Yeah. I mean, I literally know someone who made a doc and put it on his website and then submitted it, and it's fine. So, I mean, that makes it eligible. So we're really trying to open this up to people that are just doing this out of a love for radio as well as out of a career. So, okay.
Is there a time?
Oh, nothing over an hour. Because we rebroadcast a lot of the winning pieces, we have to work within time clocks as well. So, okay. Now we'll get back to the Vietnam tapes and this.
Does the hour mean 58 minutes?
Basically, yeah. I mean, we have people submit 60-minute pieces with the understanding that if it won and we wanted to broadcast the whole thing, we would then have to edit some of it out. And most people are fine, you know, feel like they could, we wouldn't want to ask them to edit much more than that, but just bring it down to workable limitations for us. So, but the chances are in that case, because we only have a 2-hour broadcast and want to represent more of a selection of what comes in, we wouldn't necessarily broadcast the full hour. So anyway, okay, so on to the Vietnam tapes.
Every death is a tragedy, and I don't buy into any given death was more tragic than the others, okay?
Can you just hear the opening?
Yeah. But in this, of all the 58,000 tragedies, this is one that's very close to me.
Well, where to begin? There's so much to tell you about. We've been real lucky with the rain so far. It's rained only about 4 of the days we've been here, and the rest of the time we've been busy every hour, every minute, with setting in and digging in, preparing fields of fire, clearing fields of fire, patrolling, ambushing, standing 50% security at night, stringing up barbed wire, trip flares, and other goodies. The terrain is majestic. It's like something out of Heidi. The view is magnificent. And just as sinister as it is magnificent. Sinister because this is the perfect terrain, the perfect country for mortar attacks. And the VC have made use of it.
My name is Tim Duffy. At the time I was in Vietnam, I was Corporal Tim Duffy, United States Marine Corps, 2199108. Mike, at the time, was a Lance Corporal when we were together in October and November of 1966.
Here's another man you'll get to know through the tapes here, if I'm able to hang on to the recorder. Mr. Tim Duffy.
I got to know Mike back in Okinawa. He introduced himself one night.
We met in Okinawa in September of 1966. Then we took the USS Iwo Jima down to Vietnam. Then we moved up to what was called Payable Hill, which was located between the rock pile and the Razorback, approximately 4,000 to 5,000 yards south of the demilitarized zone in Quang Tri Province. And early on, I was sitting in on my rack, writing a letter to my parents, and I looked up and I saw a guy playing with a tape recorder. He saw me looking at him, and I'll be doggone, he stood up, walked down, and says, "Hi, my name's Mike Baranowski."
I have the recorder here, and I'm going to try to keep it elevated off the ground and away from everything here. I'm going to try to keep it up in the air, because everything I touch here eats through my skin or bites me or rots something. This is something else. The grass will cut you. The mud will rot your skin. This is something else.
We're in my bunker, or actually not even the bunker, because the Marine Corps calls them fighting holes, dug down into the side of the mountain, into the mud, and with a mud bench and a grenade sump. In case a grenade lands, you kick it down under the hole in the floor. And what we would do was, during the day, you had some free time if you were not on patrol or on operation. You'd have like 4 hours on and 4 hours off hole watch during the day. So if Mike happened to have his free time while I'm on hole watch, he would come down with his tape recorder and we would tape while I'm on hole watch.
This is the 35-watt voice of station MOXE, broadcasting to you from the swamps, jungles, boondocks, and infected salad of Fort McCourt, home of the fighting 1st Platoon of Hungry Eye Company, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, defensive perimeter, just north of the rock pile and just south of the demilitarized zone of Vietnam. This is Watered Concrete in New York with the late world news. Washington. From the nation's capital.
I remember taping that comedy session, and we did it in my fighting hole, and I can see him sitting there doing that tape.
This portion of our programming is brought to you by 20 Round Burst, the candy bar voted best tax waste of the war.
Mike had made me go out and buy a harmonica, and he gave me one lesson, how to hold my tongue and play one note at a time. But he knew he wanted background music for all this crazy crap, so he, you know, made me learn how to, quote, play the harmonica. And that's me in the background with the Marine Corps hymn.
Don't be one of those unfortunates who suffer tragically from that malady sometimes referred to as Viet Cong yellow-striped fever. Stoop, stoop, stupefy your friends and maim your enemies. Exercise your God-given right to kill or maim at a distance. It's a great feeling to know that you can wipe out your entire neighborhood. Yes, be the first kid on your block to rule the world. See your Marine Corps recruiter today.
I really think Mike and I were just such kindred spirits. Yeah. Ironically, I don't ever remember us sitting around talking about the potential that one of us would die. You know, we just were not sitting there waiting to die.
I just don't know what to say. I'm a total loss for words here. I'm looking out of a window now, a hole in the sandbag wall in the back of the hooch. Looking out toward the east, out toward home. Long way from home. Actually, I guess home is closer straight down.
So, that the whole story behind this piece is that his sister found these tapes in her attic and sent them to Tim Duffy 20 years later. And so he came forth to the producers with the material. But it was really something to recover. So, how many hours of tapes? Oh, this, I'm not sure how many he brought back that Tim recovered. this is produced into a half-hour documentary. You hear a really, really good amount of the tapes, though, which is something that we really liked about the production. Tim comes in and speaks very eloquently about his friends, but it's also a lot of the actual original footage. So, okay, so that was the gold prize winner. You know, I just pulled the excerpts. Sorry, that one is on our website. And actually, Tim also has an extensive website in honor of Michael Baranowski. If you go to the Third Coast website and look in our archives for the winning pieces, there's a link to Tim's website. And he put up the whole memorial. There's beautiful photos. There's his website as well. Yeah, Ken?
When you get audio like that, I'm just curious how far you feel it's appropriate to go in cleaning up the audio.
Well, that was... Yeah.
As good as you can technically get it.
Yeah.
It loses its content.
We don't do any of the production. This is just an entry that came into us, so it's already completely done. And my guess is that they probably cleaned it up as much as they could and judged that it was intelligible enough to put on the radio. They probably just made the best out of the situation. Yeah, so that was, I mean, this was already presented to us part and parcel, so. Yeah, well, he talks about wanting to pursue radio afterward. So in a way, I mean, there's all this beautiful sort of tribute to, in the end, he did end up on the radio for thousands of people. And yeah, well, it was, we continued it. It, you know, it aired through NPR, and this piece generated more listener commentary than almost any piece they aired that whole year from people. So, yeah. It's the same piece, yeah.
So NPR just submitted it?
The producers submitted it separately. It gets really tricky with NPR owning rights to things and, you know, what producers can submit. So. Yeah. Well, Lost and Found Sound Series, I think, has a separate arrangement with NPR to retain the rights so they can do stuff like this and do their own thing with it, post it on their website. And
did they say where he was from? What part of the United States?
I'm trying to... Okay. I'm next going to play a piece. This was, it's 8 minutes long. It's called Heroin. It was produced by the Radio Rookies program at WNYC, which is a program where they're going into local neighborhoods there and working with the kids to produce radio and putting their stories on the air. So this particular piece is about a girl confronting her father about his heroin addiction. So it's just called Heroin. Janice Nieves is the rookie producer, and she worked along with Marianne McCune and Serena Patel. And this was, again, the Silver Award winner.
And this?
Yeah.
What do you want?
Number four.
That's it. Okay, now get up here.
Yeah. My father's block is full of... I just told myself, okay, let's keep it moving. It's time to go up the stairs so we can do this.
Here. I'm at the door.
I stood there for about a half an hour, and he never showed. My mom and I don't always see eye to eye, but we do have one thing in common, and that's Bobby.
And he betrayed you guys too, just like he did mommy.
I called my mom in the kitchen while she was cooking chicken and fries.
That was his personality like. He's always been a good person, very lovable, understanding, very attentive. Basically the kind of person that you wouldn't think one day they would actually, you know, use drugs.
I can't remember when exactly it all started. What I do remember is the park we used to play in. There was this gate that was always locked. We had to climb over it to get in. I always had this scare because I hated climbing that gate. I would get laughed at because I was too heavy to push my own weight. But my daddy would come and give me a push, and I would always make it. And I loved him for that. I loved being daddy's little girl. Maybe that's why my mother didn't tell me about my dad's drug problem.
I thought you never were going to believe him because your father had you brainwashed.
I remember my father asked me to pee in a vitamin bottle one day. At the time, I didn't know why. I didn't really want to question him neither. But later, I found out that it was because he was on drugs and he needed clean pee to prove he was drug free.
Cooking my spaghetti in the sauce.
Now my brother and I try to laugh about the situation. We try to act like everything is alright.
Ricky. Cooking my spaghetti in the sauce Ricky. When we're coming through, looking at Patricia with the...
Ricky. Guess what? Omar goes to a military school upstate. We were having a ball in the car on his way back to school. Omar doesn't see Pop a lot now. Saw Pop yesterday?
Yeah.
And how was he doing?
He was all right. You know, he was skinny just like himself. Like, he's probably like my size or even a little bit skinnier.
There are times where I don't want to be seen with him in the street. He looks crazy with his shopping cart full of cans. But that's not the only way he gets his money.
He maintains all the buildings on this block.
I ran into my cousin Robert when I went back to find Poppy the second time.
He mops all of them.
Wow, he mops all the buildings.
Maybe I should bring him for like a career day. And I can have him stand in front of his house.
Ooh.
What do you do? I mop all the buildings. Let's pray somebody's there.
I just want to talk.
This time, Poppy was there. While he was in the bathroom, I saw his shopping cart. These are his.
Slow down,
my goodness. We got Poland Springs water. We got our Pepsi, some King Cobra beer, and a square box. He's kind of stinky, so I want to walk away now. When he finally came out the bathroom, I went at it. I wasted no time. Hey, Pa. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good.
Are you serious?
Yes.
But, you're a heroin addict. That makes you feel good?
Yes.
So, how do you feel when I see you like this?
See me like that.
What makes you want to go and get cash from the garbage and take it to the supermarket? I mean, what makes you want to do that?
Because I have to make money.
But that's not the only way you can make money.
No, which other way?
Well, you can get clean and, get other jobs.
For the deli?
No, I don't mean... Okay, that's the wrong word. I'm sorry.
The way I look, the dress, the chair, the pants?
No. Yeah. I'm talking about you doing drugs and thinking it's okay.
What do you mean it's okay? Thinking it's okay?
Yeah, but why you can't just go into a point? Why you gotta keep doing it and keep doing it? I know it's addicting, but why you gotta keep doing it? My plan was to go in there and let Poppy know that I love him. And I wanted to help. But I let my anger take over instead. I visited a drug facility and you can do it. It's not that you can't. It's that you don't want to do it. That's a better word. See, I want to see this doctor at Albert Einstein College of Medicine to help me understand how heroin addiction works. Dr. Roy Cohen told me a person has to want to stop taking drugs. To quit.
That desire depends on a lot of different things. It depends on, for some people, whether they've hit rock bottom. And usually hitting rock bottom means losing job, losing family, getting back an HIV positive test.
I like the drug. Then you want to come, you understand, you're supposed to love me no matter what, No matter what, you're supposed to love me, we'll be there, And if you're going to be there, you're not going to be,
If you was healthier, trust me, I'd be here every day. But I'm not going to sit here and look at you and let you do it, and I'm not going to say anything about it. I'm not going to stay shut because it's not right. Don't you know that this can kill you? Does that even,
Anything can kill you, Ganesh. Anything can kill you.
He had that, whatever attitude. Finally, I was telling him the truth, and he didn't want to hear it. So it just ended.
I don't want to talk about it.
So now you don't want to talk to me?
No. Not that I want to talk to you. I don't want to talk about it. The drug issue is out.
So that's it, that's you and I.
That's the interview. Yes.
Are you mad?
No, I'm not. The interview's online. Today.
I just stood there for a long time. After all that, like nothing happened. Poppy told me he wanted to buy me some cookies.
I don't have money to buy something.
But he didn't have the money.
For you.
I never expected him to tell me he didn't care about what he was doing. That's when I got angry. He doesn't care. But he's funny because he talks about he want to have a normal life. What kind of normal life? I'm going to go over there to sit down to see him look all high. And then he thinks it's all right. Because there's some 70-year-olds that they still do it and that they're all right. They have a normal life. For him, I gotta understand what it's like. I don't. My mother, She doesn't even know why I even try to talk to Poppy.
First priority.
I'm not making him my number one priority. I'm just taking the time to figure out how to get the problem. My mother's father had a drinking problem, and he died years ago. Now that seems like the only memory. I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want this.
Yeah, anything can kill you, Yanis. Anything can kill you.
To be the last memory of my father. I do want to remember laughing and playing with my brother. When my father videotaped us, everybody was happy. I want to remember the day Poppy's mother died, when I was about 6 months old. My mother says he grabbed me, he hugged me so hard, and he didn't want to let me go. I don't want to let him go neither, but I don't want to go around feeling like it's my fault anymore. Dr. Cohen says that's what people like me have to get over.
You didn't cause it. You're not responsible for it.
There's nothing I can do. The problem is, I don't know if I'll ever really believe that. For WNYC, I'm Ricky Reporter, Janice.
Janice came to the festival in the fall to accept her award, and her mom came too, and it was a really beautiful, emotional evening. She's gone on to win a couple youth media awards, and she won some scholarships to go on to college. So there's some really great positive things that came out of her working directly with the radio program, which we saw direct evidence of. So, yeah. What was the story? I don't think he ever heard it. Her family heard it. And, you know, she took some negative response from her family for portraying, of course, publicizing, portraying the family in that light. But she made conscious choices about how comfortable she was with the editing and what tape was used. And, you know, there's a lot of questions always when working with youth about how their editors work with the tape they get and what story, whose story are they really telling? Is it the story that the producer thinks is the best story, or is it the youth producer story? And those are really important questions and always raised. But we felt really solid about Janice's contribution and direction in this piece, especially. Yeah.
Do you know what the legal issues are? Could he have vetoed the story?
You know, I don't know if it would be different. You know, if that's a state issue or not. No, I don't know if. I don't know. I don't know if they could have found him to even have him listen to it in a way where he actually would have heard it and understood it. But yeah, it's a good question though. I'm sure they figured it out to the point where they were fine airing it. Yeah.
I guess he said he didn't care.
Yeah. So okay, so how much time do we have? 15 more minutes. But I'll play two more things. I'd like to play for you that Gould intro just because it's a little unlike anything else we've heard stylistically. And then I want to end on sort of a lighter note. Just make radio pieces about, you know, tragedies and disaster and sadness and what's wrong with the world. So.
Could it be fictional?
For this, what was the comment? I missed the joke. That was a. No, we. This is an ongoing debate, but for now we have the overall documentary category, specifically because we didn't want to create like an. Experimental category and say, well, this was the best of the experimental, but it, you know, implying that it wouldn't have held up against the other stuff.
You can do something experimental if it's a documentary.
Right, and we've definitely gotten some of those entries. I can't guarantee those are the pieces that are going to win, although we really want those people making that kind of work to get involved, because the more it's heard, of course, the more people open their ears to that and learn how to listen in a different way, and that's something we're also trying to help educate people to listen in different ways. Yeah. Who are the judges? We bring in 24 judges to Chicago. They're all listed on the website. We publicize those as soon as we have them, because it's really important for people to see who's judging them.
I just out of curiosity, yeah. What kind of percentage of heavy stuff and lighter fare? Is there much more of one than the other that you've seen?
It's such a variety. You know, it's really popular, and it's interesting to look at the trends in documentary work and personal narrative work especially, which is becoming ultra popular. There's a lot of programs working with teens, especially a lot of teen diary stuff going on, and a lot of those are heavier. But I'd say with the personal narratives, people are making more sort of lighthearted, a la This American Life type stuff that is has, you know, humor as an integral part of the storytelling. And but there's it's pretty balanced. I would think we have the issue category. We have to break them up internally when we're listening, just so we have a sense of how to prepare them for the judges. And like the issue-oriented stuff is really full this year, as is the cultural snapshot. So, yeah. We can only take English languages for now, simply because of the broadcast. It wouldn't be a problem to have them judged with transcripts, but for the broadcast, it'd be impossible, which is a limitation, and we have rightly been taken to task for calling ourselves international when we really mean internationally English-speaking. That's why we're trying to use the website as a tool to branch out and bring in both some of the more experimental work that might not make it to the broadcast, and also we're going to try this putting this German doc up. I don't know if people will take the time to print out the transcript or even read along with it, but yeah. Okay, so let's go on to Glenn Gould, and this is the first of the trilogy. It's called The Idea of North.
I flew north from Churchill to Coral Harbor on South Hampton Island at the end of September. Snow had begun to fall, and the country was partially covered by it. Some of the lakes were frozen around. This country, you could look down and see various shades of green in the water, and you could see the bottom of the lakes. Remember, I was up in the cockpit with a pilot, and I was forever looking out, left and right, and I could see ice floes over the Hudson's Bay. And I was always looking for a polar bear or some seals that I could spot, but unfortunately there were none. And as we flew along the east coast of Hudson's Bay, this flat,
I don't go, let me say this again, I don't go for this northmanship bit at all.
Because it just seemed endless.
I don't...
We seemed to be going to nowhere.
Not those people who do claim that...
And the further north we went,
farther north and so on. But I see it as a kind of a game, this northmanship bit, with people say, well, you know, were you ever up at the North Pole? You know, and hell, I did a dog sled trip of 22 days, and the other fellow said, well, I did one of 30 days.
For another 11 years.
Perhaps they would see themselves as more
skeptical. Sure, the North has changed my life. I can't conceive of anyone being in close touch with the North, whether he lived there all the time or simply traveled it month after month, year after year. I can't conceive of such a person being really untouched by the North for the rest of his life.
Of the mass media.
When I left in 1965, at least left the job.
This is there's some special
it wasn't because of being tired merit, of the North,
some virtue
of,
to being in the North, or anything some special virtue
as keen as ever.
In having been with the primitive people.
Servant, I was asked to do another
special
job
virtue was there in that. And,
it is most difficult to
I find
and I suppose the main reason
why
I
was
because
this is very true.
Baker Lake.
But I had and I knew very well I could not go anywhere except for a mile or two walking. I always think of the long summer nights when snow had melted. The lakes were open, and the geese and ducks had started to fly. During that time, the sun would set, but when there was still the last shimmer in the sky, I would walk out to one of those lakes and watch those ducks and geese just fly around peacefully or sitting on the water. And I felt that I was almost part of that country, part of that peaceful surrounding, and I wished that it would never end.
Are we right to open
the mass media, which is
the real truth about the North, for me as a North, is the fact that whenever I spoke to
where they do on the first white man of the North Supreme,
I think people tend to go for the more
rest of the world.
First adventure
This is Glenn Gould, and this program is called The Idea of North. I've long been intrigued by that incredible tapestry of tundra and taiga which constitutes the Arctic and subarctic of our country. I've read about it, written about it, and even pulled up my parka once and gone there. Yet, like all but a very few Canadians, I've had no real experience of the North. I've remained, of necessity, an outsider. And the North has remained for me a convenient place to dream about, spin tall tales about, and in the end, avoid. This program, however, brings together some remarkable people who have had a direct confrontation with that northern third of Canada, who've lived and worked there, and in whose lives the North has played a very vital role. There's a geographer and anthropologist, Jim Lotz, a sociologist, Frank Valley, a government official, Bob Phillips, and a nurse, Marianne Schrader. And there's also a fifth character, and therein lies a story. Several years ago, I went north aboard a train known affectionately to Westerners as the Muskeg Express, Winnipeg to Fort Churchill, 1,015 miles, two nights, one day, four double bedrooms, eight sections, diner, and coach. And at breakfast, I struck up a conversation with one W.V. McLean, or as he was known along the line and at all the hamlet sidings where his bunk car would be parked, Wally. Wally McLean is a surveyor, now retired, and within the first minutes of what proved to be a day-long conversation, he endeavored to persuade me of the metaphorical significance of his profession. He parlayed surveying into a literary tool, even as Jorge Luis Borges manipulates mirrors and Franz Kafka badgers beetles. And as he did so, I began to realize that his relation to a craft which has as its subject the land enabled him to read the signs of that land, to find in the most minute measurement a suggestion of the infinite, to encompass the universal within the particular. And so, when it came time to organize this program and to correlate the disparate views of our four other guests, I invited Wally McLean to be our narrator and to tell me how, in his view, one can best attain an idea of North.
That's as much as you hear of Gould. The rest of that hour-long piece is the four people talking and then Wally kind of coming in and serving as your guide through the piece. So, and I guess, I mean, maybe you're from Montreal, right? So maybe you could speak. My guess is that imagine hearing something like that on NPR, the beginning, the first 3 minutes of just utter confusion and beautiful just rhythm and certain words coming out at different times. And so I'm guessing that even for the CBC back then, that was pretty remarkable stuff to be nationally broadcast. So, anyway. Okay, we're going to end on, as I said, a slightly lighter note. This is one of my favorite pieces of audio that I've ever heard. It's done by an independent artist named Gregory Whitehead, who some of you may be familiar with already. He's from New York, and he does a bunch of web-based stuff and performance and radio and live performance too. And he's gotten involved with us this year. He'll be coming to the conference in November, which we're really excited about. And he brings up a really important part of all this, which I think is essential for all producers to think about, is playfulness. He brings humor into his pieces. They're highly intelligent, but they always make you laugh or chuckle to yourself or you know, he pushes you to think in a lot of different ways about things. And he's not always literal. That's the other thing I've been very interested in thinking more about, is whether documentaries have to be fictional and still true, whether work has to be literal and to tell a story accurately or completely, and what is the significance of using metaphor? How can that be just as powerful in telling a straight-ahead story? So, anyway, this one's called Ice Music. That's all I'll say. It's 2.5 minutes long.
Here at the Laboratory for Innovation and Acoustic Research, we're always looking for ways to integrate creative sound into the rhythms of everyday life. So, for example, this summer, we have been developing a technique which permits us to freeze individual sounds, in this case, sounds from brass instruments, into ice cubes. That familiar icon of the American kitchen, the ice tray. into a recording device. In theory, one could continue to add ice cubes and instruments, but in this case, we're presenting a brass choir of 6 voices to offer a few moments of gentle harmony in an increasingly cacophonous world. From the Laboratory for Innovation and Acoustic Research, until next time, this is Gregory Whitehead.
Acronym to his laboratory, LIAR. So, anyway, that's the sampling of stuff. That piece is just called Ice Music.
And that was in last year's?
That was a piece we put, we put 3 pieces by him on our website about 2 months ago. You can go back and listen to the other 2. They're equally as brilliant. He's got a whole history of doing all sorts of stuff, so. And he's producing a lot for the BBC right now. You know, his stuff isn't this kind of work, again, you probably wouldn't hear on All Things Considered. So he gets a very warm reception in Europe for his radio work, and here too as well, but he's also broadcasting other countries. So if there's any other questions, please feel free to come up and find me. I can't stay through the weekend, so you might want to find me sooner than later. There's information on the conference over there, and again, I can't really stress how much I'd love to see these 2 communities, you know, see more of you guys in the future, because the energy that's here is really strong, and I'd love to carry some of that into the Third Coast as well. So thank you for listening. Yeah.
You mentioned NPR.
Yeah.
How about PRI?
Well, PRI actually distributes our broadcast. I should have mentioned that from the top. Yeah.
See, the CBC connection is strong in Canada, so.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. PRI did, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, right. People going in.
Right. We broadcast as it happens mm-hmm. here. And it was recommended to us by a hardcore NPR guy as a good way to, as an antidote to All Things Considered.
Right, right. Well, there should be something else, you know, equally as available and well-known. So trying to think if there's anything. Yeah.
How'd you personally?
I was working at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke and was doing a little bit of radio work in the South and just felt drawn to Chicago, and pure blind luck, they were starting up this festival right then. And it was just 2 years ago, so starting at ground level on a project is really exciting because we can constantly reshape, which is why feedback at every step along the way is really valuable. And it was just sort of being in the right place at the right time. To the nth degree. So, thanks for listening. And there's much more to listen to out there, not just on our site. We have links to sites, so many sites where you can just, if you have the time and a decent enough connection, just sit around and listen. So, right.
For this year, I'll put them out. As I said, the deadline's already passed. It's just for this year, but you can get on our mailing list, and then we'll send you next year's stuff.
Thank you.
As you were talking about, because I thought it was like,